Welcome to Healthcare Rounds, the podcast serving you the ins and outs of health policy and business topics, as well as our take on the rapidly evolving healthcare delivery ecosystem. I'm your host, John Marchica, CEO of Darwin Research Group and faculty associate at the W.P. Carey School of Business and the College of Health Solutions at Arizona State University. This week, I'm speaking with Dr. David Shulkin, the former U.S. Secretary for Veterans Affairs and currently president of Shulkin Solutions. Prior to his role as secretary, Dr. Shulkin served as VA's undersecretary for health for 18 months, leading the nation's largest integrated healthcare system with over 1,700 sites of care and serving nearly 9 million veterans. Before he began his service with the VA, Dr. Shulkin held numerous chief executive roles at Morristown Medical Center and the Atlantic Health System Accountable Care Organization. He also served as president and CEO of Beth Israel Medical Center in New York City. Dr. Shulkin has held numerous physician leadership roles, including chief medical officer of the University of Pennsylvania Health System, Temple University Hospital, and the Medical College of Pennsylvania Hospital. He has also held academic positions, including chairman of medicine and vice dean at Drexel University School of Medicine. As an entrepreneur, Dr. Shulkin funded and served as chairman and CEO of Dr. Quality, one of the first consumer sources of information on quality and safety in healthcare. A board-certified internist, Dr. Shulkin is also a fellow of the American College of Physicians. He received his medical degree from the Medical College of Pennsylvania, and he completed his internship at Yale University School of Medicine and a residency and fellowship in general medicine at the University of Pittsburgh Presbyterian Medical Center. Dr. Shulkin has been named as one of the 50 most influential physician executives in the country by Modern Healthcare. And he's also previously been named among the 100 most influential people in American healthcare. Well, thanks for taking time to speak with me today. I really appreciate it, Dr. Shulkin.
Sure.
I'm halfway through your book.
Okay.
So I sat down yesterday. We were up at our cabin in Prescott and was hoping to power through the whole thing, but got through about half of it. It's very good. Really enjoying it. So, and that's, we're going to talk about a lot today about your book, but for those listeners who aren't aware of your background before being a secretary of the VA, tell me a little bit about your background before becoming the undersecretary of the VA in the Obama administration.
I first trained as an internist, and following my clinical training, I did a program called the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Clinical Scholars Program, which was at the University of Pennsylvania, where I got trained in skills beyond medicine, mostly focusing on the science of how to change physician behavior and how to change behavior in a way that would help improve quality, safety, and cost effectiveness. And that led me into a management career where I became the first chief medical officer of an academic center at the University of Pennsylvania, which was really the intersection between behavior change, finance, and medicine. I was the chief medical officer at Penn for about 10 years, and then I went out and did a startup company in transparency in healthcare to try to improve the ability to get rewarded for doing better in healthcare, for improving quality and safety. And following that experience, I went back into management and became the president and CEO of Beth Israel Medical Center in New York City and the president of a hospital system, Morristown Medical Center in Northern New Jersey, before I went into government.
So I think for myself, and maybe for many of our listeners, the VA is this sort of black box. So give me an idea of the history and just the scope of the Veterans Administration.
Most people don't recognize how large a health system the VA is. It's the largest healthcare system in the country. It's the second largest federal agency. You have the Department of Defense, and then you have the Department of Veteran Affairs. It has about 375,000 employees, a budget of over $200 billion a year. There are about 1,000 medical facilities in every part of the country, and in fact outside the country, because its mission is to serve those places where veterans live. And many veterans live in areas like the Philippines or in Guam or even in other remote parts of the world. And so the VA has that responsibility to care for those who have served the country. The VA really started to grow rapidly after World War II. It became a cabinet agency when Ronald Reagan was president. So it was one of the last cabinet groups or cabinet agencies to have its own secretary in the government. But its real commitment to veterans was started back in the Civil War when Abraham Lincoln, in his second inaugural address, made a statement that now sits outside the walls of the VA in Washington, D.C., that says that it's the responsibility of the country to care for those who have borne the battle, which is really our veterans.
And how many are currently being served?
There are approximately 20 million American veterans today. The VA serves all of its veterans in one way or another, but the healthcare system, which is one component of the mission that VA has, serves about 9.3 million veterans.
Is that the remainder of those? Is that because they're insured, either getting Medicare benefits or in the private sector?
Yeah, the healthcare system that VA has is not available to all veterans. It is available to those who have a service connection. That means that they developed a injury or disability or illness during their time of service, or if they meet low income requirements so that they're unable to afford care or are not covered by other insurances. So it's a little bit less than half of American veterans that are eligible and choose to get their care through the VA in its healthcare system. But the VA also provides benefits that many people know about, which is the GI Bill for education, the home loan program, so that veterans can have more affordable chances to own their own home, and many other benefits, including disability benefits.
So one of the problems that you write about in your book was about wait times at the VA. And so tell me a little bit about that situation that you walked into and how you addressed the problem. I thought it was fascinating.
I was a private sector CEO running a hospital system in northern New Jersey. And like most Americans, read in the newspaper that the Department of Veteran Affairs was having a significant problem in being able to provide access to its veterans. In fact, it was brought out in a congressional hearing that potentially 40 veterans had died in Phoenix, Arizona, waiting for care. That became a national scandal. It was a horrible situation that the President Obama at the time asked for the resignation of the secretary and the undersecretary. And I, like many probably people listening, were really sad to see that happen and thought, boy, I wish there was something I could do. And I eventually got a call from the White House asking whether I could help them fix the situation. When I finally walked into the VA after a very long process of congressional vetting, and it was about more than a year after this had brought to the public attention, and I walked into a VA that, frankly, I didn't feel had sufficiently begun to address the problem or fix the access issues. And finally, it came clear to me that they weren't asking the right question. They were just looking at how many veterans were waiting for care. But I thought the right question was which veterans needed to be seen first. And when I got the data to suggest that veterans with urgent care problems were not being seen in a timely fashion, that's where we began to focus our attention to fixing the access problem. And so shortly after I arrived at the VA, I announced that we were going to have what was called a national stand down, which is a military term for focusing on something that's very important and paying all of your attention on that problem until the problem is addressed. And so we opened up every VA medical center across the country and made sure that every veteran with an urgent medical care problem was seen immediately. And once we were able to do that in a relatively short period of time, we put into place same day services for veterans at every VA medical center to make sure that no veteran with an urgent medical problem ever had to wait again. And finally, we published all of our wait times publicly so that veterans and even the employees who work in the VA could see what those wait times are in case they did start to rise again, that we wouldn't ever reach a situation like we had in 2014. And subsequently, we've done research and published a study in the Journal of the American Medical Association that shows that now the Department of Veteran Affairs has significantly shorter wait times than the public sector when you measure it across averages. And that during the period of time that I became undersecretary till now, that VA had significantly reduced its wait time, where the private sector has remained about the same as it has over the past couple of years. So it really showed that we were able to address the problem of wait times, that it's far better now than it had been. And the public transparency that we report on wait times, the only health system in the country that I'm aware of that does that, I think gives confidence that this problem is not going to recur.
Did you meet any resistance from administrators and other employees when you decided to post those wait times publicly?
Yeah, frankly, the situation was that I had developed with the staff at the VA the ability to post wait times many months earlier than we actually went live with them. And that was during the Obama administration. There was resistance to publishing the wait times. There was a sense that if we published the wait times, that it would end up becoming a political liability because somewhere in the country there would be long wait times. And that's where a congressperson might focus the attention and say, why is my district the one with long wait times? Or there might be a reporter somewhere that would do a front page story showing the wait times were terrible in several parts of the country. And so the decision was made that I would not be allowed to publish the wait times because it was politically too much of a liability. When I became secretary under President Trump, President Trump didn't have the same type of concerns. He was much more interested in just making changes to the current system. And so those resistances to publishing completely went away. And so one of the very first things I did was to push the button to publish all of our data. And I felt even if there was a backlash, it was still the right thing to do, that I'm a strong believer that transparency and public display of data is one of the strongest motivators to change. And it's the way that we should be improving healthcare. And in fact, after I published it, there was no backlash, and it was a strong influencer in the ability for our medical centers to continue to get better and to watch their own results.
Yeah, it seems to me that that a culture of transparency in healthcare was something that really started under Obama, the Obama administration, and has continued through the Trump administration, that there's a belief that in publishing pricing or in publishing outcomes, that it will foster some healthy competition among those that are falling behind to say, hey, let's step up our game. So the other issue that you faced, if I remember as secretary, trying to get my timeline right in the book. And by the way, I should have mentioned at the start, Dr. Shulkin's book is It Shouldn't Be This Hard to Serve Your Country, Our Broken Government and the Plight of Veterans. It's available today. And as I mentioned, I'm powering my way through it. And it's very, very good. But the other issue was behavioral health, and in particular, suicides. Walk me through, because obviously I like other consumers of healthcare information, kind of track this in the papers, but from your perspective, what was going on and how did you address that issue?
Well, The issue is that suicide is a public health crisis across the country among all Americans. We see it in teenagers. We see it in older patients or older Americans in general. But when you look at it in the veteran population, it is a much higher rate than you find even in the general population. And so it's become a crisis situation, particularly in the VA. Over 20 veterans a day take their life by suicide, an astounding figure, one that's very alarming. And I would continually meet with parents of children who had taken their lives by suicide. And these were, you know, normal children who had entered the military. And a couple of years later now, the parents find themselves, you know, mourning their child. And so this was really a devastating situation. So I decided to make the prevention of veteran suicide the single highest clinical priority of the Department of Veteran Affairs. Now, making it a priority focuses people's attention, it focuses resources, it helps get the word out, but it doesn't necessarily solve the problem. And unfortunately, there is no magic bullet to preventing veteran suicide. It's a complex issue. So we had to address it through a multifaceted approach. That data suggested that only 6 veterans a day of those 20 taking their lives were getting their health care in the VA system. So there were 14 a day that were out in the community somewhere. And my concern was that they weren't getting any connection with care. So we started a campaign that Tom Hanks became our spokesman for, to get the word out to people outside the VA system that we needed everybody's help in identifying and addressing veteran suicide. And so we worked with state and local governments. We worked with not-for-profit organizations. We worked with churches. We worked with veteran service groups, community by community, to really develop a community network to help identify and address those that were in need. And those efforts are continuing. And I believe that they will have an impact. It may not be a quick one, but that this is really the only way to begin to address getting people help that feel so isolated and hopeless that suicide has become their only option.
You mentioned that it's the reasons or what's behind it, that they're complex issues. Can you frame that a little better for me? And just what are some of the root causes, and why are veterans suffering at such a higher rate?
I think you have to look at the underlying reasons why this happens. And of course, looking at issues like depression, looking at issues such as post-traumatic stress, substance abuse, chronic pain, these are all underlying issues that lead towards, you know, this type of devastating result. But if you look at the data, the highest incidence of suicide is that 1-year period after somebody leaves the active military and they become a veteran. And what that tells you is that people have left an environment which has been structured, where they've had peers, where they've been in a place where people understand them and have a shared experience. And now they enter a new culture back in the real world, where they often don't feel understood and don't have that support network. And so one of the things I did as secretary was extend mental health benefits for 1 year after everybody leaves the military, and really focus our efforts on how do we transition people out of the military in a safer, more effective way. But the highest number of veterans, while the incidence is highest during that first year of leaving active military, the very largest number of veterans taking their lives are the older veterans, now mostly Vietnam veterans, where social isolation and loneliness becomes a huge factor in this problem. And so we were working very hard to connect people in support systems with one another and use peer support to try to address this issue of social isolation.
Sure. Yeah, it's a serious a serious problem. So, Dr. Shulkin, you worked under two administrations, and in the book, you point out some of the differences. Can you give me sort of the plus minus, the good and bad for each administration when it came to making and implementing decisions?
Yeah. In the Obama administration, I entered 6.5 years into his administration. So it was a very well-oiled machine. There was a very clear path to decision-making. It was a very analytic approach and thoughtful approach to making policy. And that issue is one where policymaking is often comprehensive, but it can be slow in adoption. The Trump administration was almost the opposite, where there was no defined process of making policy, at least in the beginning of his administration, and that allowed for a much quicker rate of change and ability to make more impactful policy decisions quicker. And since I had been in the previous administration, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I had a game plan. I had a formula for how we were evolving and changing the VA. So the Trump administration's ability to move quickly, I think, actually worked in favor of us reforming the VA in a quicker way, because we were able to get a lot done. That very first year I was secretary under President Trump, we got 11 bills through Congress, all with bipartisan support, and to the president's desk for signature. And many of the policy changes that we made hadn't been able to be made in the last decade or so. So they were very different styles. I think in the end, at least in my experience, what I talk about in the book is that this undefined way of making policy and the sort of chaos that surrounded the Trump administration, while it worked well in the beginning, ultimately ended up becoming a political liability for the VA, and VA became more politicized, which had never really happened in the past. The VA had been treated as a non-political entity, always dealt with in a bipartisan fashion, but some of the political ongoing activities in the Trump administration brought some of those politics into the VA. And that's one of the things that I hope that we can bring back to a sense of normality, because the VA should not be viewed as a political organization.
And yet, if I remember correctly, you're the only cabinet secretary that received 100-0 vote for your approval to be selected. And so I would imagine that some of those bills in your first year, some of the support came from having strong congressional support as well. So, and at the same time, you also write about the politicals, and there was a sense that you were being undermined. And I'm just getting to that part in the book. But my sense is that any administration, you have these polls, but that this was different. And I can't for the life of me understand the relationship between Mr. Perlmutter and I can't remember the other person's name, but basically the Mar-a-Lago faction in trying to influence decisions at the VA. Talk to me a little bit about that dynamic.
First of all, I worked very hard to make sure that politics stayed out of VA when I was secretary. And yes, I did get 100-0 confirmation, but I think most of the senators and congressmen that work with me would tell you to this day they don't know if I'm a Democrat or a Republican. And that's exactly the way that I wanted it, because when it comes to taking care of our veterans, I don't believe that that's relevant. But I think that you've seen now in the current administration a lot of things that are happening that haven't happened in the past in the same way. So the current secretary, of course, did not get a 100-0 confirmation. Was seen in much more of a political perspective when he went through his confirmation. But more importantly, I think that we've seen, even in these recent impeachment hearings, public servants coming forward, much with a story very similar to mine, saying that they were focused on their job, focused on the mission and the work of government. And there was outside interference. There were people that were coming in and telling them how to do their job and making it more difficult and ultimately undermining the confidence that the president had in them to do that job, whether that was fair or not. And so I think that what I write about in the book and my concern for public service and for how we operate the government is that there are many people that are dedicated public servants, really focused on the work of the American people, and that it's very important that we allow them to do these jobs outside of political influence and that they be allowed to effectively deliver on why they came to government in the first place. Otherwise, people may no longer be willing to come and serve government. And I think that would be to the detriment of the way that government works.
Yeah, this is what I just don't understand. And I can rephrase my question, but there's always been these political appointees in any administration. But yet, in this particular administration, and I'm not, coming down on President Trump or anyone else, but it just seems to be, and maybe it is heightened by the recent impeachment hearings and watching these people come forth and just say, I'm just trying to do my job. Why is it that this administration is so different in that regard?
I think there's a couple reasons. I think that, depending upon how much people have looked into this, the period of the transition between one administration to another is a pretty important time to set the path for the new administration. And I think that there's a lot of evidence that the transition of when President Trump entered office was not as formalized and as rigorous as probably could have been. And so therefore, when the political appointees came into many of the agencies, they came in really not understanding their agencies quite as much as we've seen in past administrations. And I think that if you put people into jobs who don't fully understand the agencies that they're in, there are consequences to that. I think, secondly, President Trump has a clearly different style of management and of decision-making than we've seen with many past presidents. Certainly a very sharp distinction to the way that President Obama makes decisions. President Trump is much quicker to make decisions, much more a believer in his own internal gut feelings and beliefs, doesn't necessarily involve as many people in the decision-making process as past presidents have done. And so therefore, there's much greater influence to some of these political appointees in influencing decisions and in influencing the president. And so I think that we're seeing a very different style, and we're seeing very different way that government's managed. And as you know, this country is extremely split and divisive right now, so that, half the people think that that's what was needed and support the president's style in doing that. And half the people in the country believe that that's taking us in the wrong direction. And so when it comes to people who are in government, like I was, to support veterans, and you're trying to keep this out of the political arguments, you're trying to stay focused on doing what's right for veterans, it is a very challenging environment in which to manage, because people are constantly trying to pull you into one of the political spectrums.
So your book is called It Shouldn't Be This Hard to Serve Your Country. If there is a single message that you're trying to get across when you sat down and wrote this, what's the main theme?
What's interesting is the title, It Shouldn't Be This Hard to Serve Your Country, actually has a dual meaning. So it's actually two themes. The first is that I believe that if there's one group of Americans who deserve the very best services and care that this country can offer, it's our veterans. And that's the reason I chose to leave the private sector to come to the VA, with a belief that if you go off and you raise your hand and put your life on the line for the country, and you come back and you need our help, you shouldn't have to go through long waits or bureaucracy or red tape. You should be able to get access to the very best care that's available. And that's what That means that it shouldn't be this hard to serve your country. The book is written for veterans. It's about how do we improve the VA. And my strong belief that the VA is an essential component of our national security system, and it must be a sustainable, strong institution if we're going to continue to have a volunteer military. But the second meaning of the book is really about my personal experience of going into public service, where I say it shouldn't be this hard to serve your country, that coming to focus on making government better should be about the mission of government and the agency you work in, instead of being about trying to deal with the politics and dealing with the political appointees and the environment that we see in Washington today of personal attacks and just such a toxic environment that it really is very difficult to do public service today. And I'm concerned we're seeing a brain drain of really talented people leaving the government, and worse yet, people that would normally think about going to government saying, no, I won't go now, seeing what's going on in Washington. And ultimately, I think that's going to hurt all of us if we don't have a reset of the environment in Washington that we see today.
One question I wanted to ask you that you do address, why is it that privatizing the VA is such a bad idea?
When I came to VA, I came from the private sector knowing that I was entering a health system in crisis. And I had a very open mind on this issue. I thought, look, if I come in and see that the VA is so broken and so dysfunctional and so bureaucratic that it can't be fixed, that one of the real possibilities might be, why don't we just shut it down and transfer all the veterans into the private sector, a system that I knew very well in the private sector. And when I got to the VA and I began to really understand what it does and how it functions, I did this by putting on a white coat and going and seeing patients myself, seeing veterans. I began to understand that the VA system provides a service and a level of care that is not available in the private sector, that it does very different things for veterans than you could just get by sending them to private doctors and hospitals. And so once I began to understand that the VA was filling in an important gap in care that veterans wouldn't get in the private sector, and secondly, that we could fix the VA, that we could make the changes, that it was not an intractable situation, I began to feel very strongly that it was essential that we maintain the VA and that we make it a strong, modern healthcare system, that the VA had been dealing with decades of systemic problems that frankly just needed to be reformed and fixed. And that's exactly what I began to do. But having said that, I also recognized that the VA couldn't do this alone, that the VA needed to work with the private sector, where the private sector were doing things better quality or providing higher level services, that veterans should be able to access the private sector. And so when I first entered the VA, about 19% of veterans were getting the care that they needed in the private sector. When I left the VA, that number was 36%. So I was tapping into the private sector and beginning to build a hybrid system between the strengths of what the VA did and the strengths of the private sector. And the difficult challenge I had in a very politicized environment was that I was creating sort of a middle compromise system between the best of the private sector and the best of the VA. And the political arguments were much more sort of at the spectrum. Some people felt that there shouldn't be any VA, it should all be privatized. And other people felt it should be all government, no private sector. And of course, being in the middle in Washington these days is a pretty lonely place to be. You don't have very many friends.
Right. So before we wrap this up, tell me a little bit about what you're focused on now. I know that you've got your own consulting practice, you're working with some health systems, but just let people know that your days aren't over.
Well, I continue to feel strongly about advocating for veterans, and I continue to do that in a number of ways. My book is certainly one way of doing that, sharing with future leaders about what was working and what wasn't working, and really defining a path forward for the VA. I work with veterans organizations and continue to support not-for-profits that are advocating on behalf of veterans. But the rest of my time I spend on trying to make a difference in healthcare and working with organizations and companies that I believe are truly transformative and trying to move the model of more affordable, accessible, higher quality care faster. And it's very exciting for me to be out there working with people who are trying to change the world and make things better. And if I can continue to be impactful and to advocate from a different place than I did when I was in government, that's what I'll continue to do.
Well, Dr. Shulkin, it's been a pleasure. And I sincerely hope that one of these days with one of those high impact projects that you and I get a chance to work together. Don't know exactly what that would look like,
great,
but it would be a lot of fun. And I appreciate your taking some time today.
Thank you.
To talk to me. And again, thank you.
Thank you so much. Take care now.
That's all for this week. From all of us at Darwin Research Group, thanks for listening. If you haven't yet done so, please rate and review Healthcare Rounds wherever you listen to podcasts. Healthcare Rounds is produced by Diana Nikolic and engineered by Andrew Rojek. Theme music by John Marchica. Darwin Research Group provides advanced market intelligence and in-depth customer insights to healthcare executives. Our strategic focus is on healthcare delivery systems and the global shift toward value-based care. To learn more about us, go to darwinresearch.com or send an email to insights@darwinresearch.com. Or if you'd like to get right to it, call us at 888-402-3465. See you next round.